Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Sarah, and I too would like to welcome everyone to the Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop, HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer, what's new in the treatment and quality of life. And today's program is actually made possible by an educational grant from Daiichi Sankyo and an independent grant from Merck and Company, Inc. And I really want to thank them for their support of this program. Now, we have many participants on the program today. We have over 101 participants, and you come from all of the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Canada, East Africa, Malawi, Philippines, Uganda, and the United Kingdom. So it's truly a global call. And there's a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us to learn more about the treatment of HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Saranya Shrimshi. Dr. Shrimshi is Professor of Oncology, Mayo Clinic Breast Disease Group Research Co-Chair, Mayo Clinic HER2 Working Group Co-Chair, Jacoby Center for Breast Health, Mayo Clinic Cancer Center. And Dr. Shrimshi will be addressing HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer, biomarker, genomic, and diagnostic testing, grade, and hormone receptors. Standard treatment options, including targeted therapy, and key questions to ask your healthcare team. It's my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Shrimshi.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Messner and the team at inviting me to talk today. So I was tasked to talk about HER2-positive breast cancer, I think with biomarker, genomic, and diagnostic tests. So we'll start with the term HER2-positive breast cancer first, right? So what is HER2? So HER2 is actually comes from human epidermal growth factor receptor 2. So HER2 is one of the receptor, family member in what we call HER family member. So there's actually four of the receptor in family, and HER2 is one of the protein that, about a quarter of breast cancer hijack this particular protein to help them grow. This particular receptor is actually expressed in normal tissue too, but, about 20% or so of breast cancer use this particular receptor to help them grow. Signaling through this particular pathway commonly help these cells, proliferate so they grow. It's also helped with the cell survival. So these cells are, traditionally in the past, more difficult to kill. And then this particular receptor also help increase, invasiveness and so that's why this type of breast cancer can spread early. On the other hand, we come a long way with anti-HER2 therapy. This type of breast cancer used to have really poor outcome, but right now this is one of the best cancers to treat because we have, variety of anti-HER2 therapy that we use in the clinic now that can help improve outcome of patients with HER2-positive breast cancer. So when we talk about the term biomarker, so biomarker, it's, a test basically that we use, in the lab to identify, how patient is going to do with the treatment. So we do have two types of the, what we call biomarkers. So they're what we call prognostic biomarkers. So these are biomarkers or tests that we use to test on patient's cancer to basically tell us how patient is going to do, you know, basically regardless of the treatment. There is another type of biomarker, what we call predictive biomarker. So these are, you know, basically the tests that we use to identify or predict which therapy would be beneficial for each patient. So HER2 is one of the, you know, both of that predictive and prognostic biomarker, because this particular protein, you know, generally make the cells more aggressive. So prognostic wise, used to be a bad prognosis, but on the other hand, it's predict against, you know, response to anti-HER2 therapy, and the outcome of these patients has significantly improved in the past few decades or so. So in order for the diagnostic test, so how do we tell whether patients have HER2 positive or not? Most often time for the diagnostic test for HER2 positive or HER2 receptor, what we commonly do is that we normally test the protein testing of this particular receptor. So if you remember from biology class 101, you know, DNA make RNA, make protein, right? So because protein is the thing that function in the cell, so we normally start with testing the protein first, and that sometimes what we call immunohistochemistry. So you might have seen people talk about HER2 IHC or immunohistochemistry testing, staining of 1, 0, 1 plus, 2 plus, or 3 plus. Conventionally, you know, quote-unquote HER2 positive breast cancer would have high expression of HER2 protein, what we call HER2 3 plus. So that is considered as HER2 positive. On the other hand, for 1 plus and 2 plus, if it's, you know, when we have the protein testing result come back in the gray zone, particularly with 2 plus, then we try to go back to look at, you know, HER2 amplification or looking at DNA amplification. And we use some tests, what we call FISH or, you know, fluorescent insectoid hybridization, or like SISH test that looking at DNA amplification, just to give us, you know, black and white answer whether it's positive or negative. Most commonly, HER2 positive breast cancer, so kind of similar to other breast cancer, the majority also has hormone receptor positive too. So about 60% or so would be hormone receptor positive. So this is what we call hormone receptor positive and HER2 positive breast cancer. You might have heard some of us might call it triple positive. So that's, you know, kind of in contrast to triple negative. So all three receptors are positive, meaning that the estrogen receptor is positive, progesterone receptor positive, and also HER2 receptors also positive. So that group of patients have, you know, a lot of treatment options available. We can target both anti-HER2 therapy and also use anti, you know, estrogen or, you know, endocrine therapy to use those patients too. And you probably will hear from Dr. Metro later on to talk about some of the new drugs. So we have some of the newer clinical trial called PATINA trial that looking at adding the CDK4/6 inhibitor, which we commonly use it in HER2 negative breast cancer, but now we actually shown that you know, this class of drug also perhaps beneficial in patients with HER2 positive and also hormone receptor positive too. Most often time these tumors, because HER2s are more aggressive. So most often time these tumors are often high grade. So when you talk about tumor grade, that is the term we use to describe how it looks under the microscope. So these are usually high grade tumor. The other thing that I was tasked to talk about is kind of like, you know, some of the standard treatment options that we have for HER2 positive breast cancer. You know, normally target these, you know, protein by conventionally you would hear, you know, we talk about things like trastuzumab or pertuzumab. So these are basically what we call monoclonal antibodies. So that is the first class of drug that we use to target HER2. So antibodies are things that, you know, let's say if you have a viral or co-infection, these are basically, you know, antibody, like our body would make antibody to attack, you know, virus or bacteria to help clear the infection. And trastuzumab and pertuzumab are basically man-made antibody that would target that. The other class of drug that we use to target HER2 is what we call tyrosine kinase inhibitor on things like lapatinib, tucatinib, neratinib. Those are small molecules inhibitor that target HER2 protein from inside of the receptor. And then there is a newer class of drug, what we call antibody drug conjugate. This is a very clever way for us to deliver the drug, you know, chemotherapy drug, right into the tumor cells. So, you know, conventionally we used to give chemotherapy, free-flowing chemotherapy through IV, you know, that go through like all of the cells and then combine that with the antibody like trastuzumab and pertuzumab. Now, we actually combine them together. So instead of giving free-flowing chemotherapy, we link these, you know, cytotoxic payload or chemotherapy linked with these antibody. So, you know, as you can imagine, when trastuzumab or antibody binds to HER2 receptor, then the cancer cell will eat up this complex because it doesn't like anything hanging around outside of the cell. And then we use that for our advantage. So once cancer cell eats up this complex, there is an enzyme in the lysosome that would break the linker. And then once the linker break, these chemotherapy come out and kill the tumor cell from inside. This is the reason why people call this clever way to deliver the drug, like, you know, some a kind of Trojan horse, right? You put the little soldier inside of the horse, and then once it get in, you know, it come these chemotherapy come out and kill the tumor cell from inside. So you get more specific target killing, and then that has, you know, significantly improved outcome. And I think that's what Dr. Metro is gonna talk to. And then there are some other new drugs in the horizon. There is another drug called mirvetuximab that basically is an, you know, monoclonal antibody that target HER2 but has the, you know, genetically engineer the binding part that help improve the binding. And then there's some other newer treatment on the horizon too, that you know, I think we are in the exciting time for the, you know, targeted treatment for HER2 positive breast cancer right now. And then I'll turn that back to Dr. Messner, and Dr. Metro will talk to you more about those new treatments. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Shamsu. That was just a wonderful presentation, and because you are the first speaker, you really set the tone for today's program, so thank you so much. And our next speaker, and I'm sure there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Dr. Jennifer Metro, and Dr. Metro is co-director, breast oncology, Fair Oaks Innova Sklar Cancer Institute, Innova Health. And Dr. Metro will be discussing how biomarker testing informs treatment decisions, updates on investigational new drugs and clinical trials, how research contributes to your treatment options, and what's new in the prevention and management of treatment side effects, symptoms, discomfort, neuropathy, and pain. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Metro.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. It's a pleasure for me to be here. I have a little bit of a hoarse voice that I'm getting over, so hopefully I can project well. So just piggybacking off my colleagues, I'll talk about sort of what informs our treatment decisions and sort of the standard of care therapies that we currently use, and a lot of really exciting things, I think, the take-home point to remember about HER2 positive breast cancer is we have come such a long way in the last 20 years, and we are making really great and rapid strides in terms of broadening the number of therapies that are available and how long that we can treat this disease for. It's really turned into a chronic disease. So biomarker testing is really the backbone of our treatment decision making. Whenever somebody is diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer, we have to confirm those three receptors that Dr. Chubbsri mentioned. So we check the estrogen receptor, progesterone receptor, and HER2. And regardless of what the ER and PR are, if you are HER2 positive, that sort of defines your course going forward. So if you're HER2 positive, then we know that you're going to benefit from the HER2-directed therapies, and so those are incorporated from the very beginning, and those are going to be what drives your treatment going forward. More and more, we also are doing what we call next generation sequencing, or basically testing or DNA testing of the cancer cells themselves. So this is distinct from genetic testing that we offer a lot of women to see if they have mutations like BRCA or CHEK2, to see if there's a familial component. This is really looking for different mutations that are driving the cancer to grow, because there are now therapies that are much more effective in tumors that harbor specific mutations. And while that's very, very common in hormone positive, HER2 negative breast cancer, we are seeing it starting to be used in HER2 positive breast cancer as well. So the standard of care for most women when they're, or patients when they're diagnosed with HER2 positive metastatic breast cancer, for the last about 13 up until Sunday, I think, so this is hot off the press, was a combination of medications with a taxane, so either Taxol or Taxotere, and Herceptin and Perjeta. So Herceptin and Perjeta are the two HER2 targeted antibodies that were mentioned earlier. And the Cleopatra clinical trial was a study that basically defined how we now treat HER2 positive breast cancer in the first line. First line meaning you're diagnosed with metastatic disease, what's the first type of medicine that you're going to get? And the Cleopatra trial showed that by adding pertuzumab or Perjeta to the Herceptin and the taxane chemo, that patients stayed on therapy much, much longer, and they actually lived much, much longer. And so that became the backbone of our treatment. And since then, we've had other drugs that have come into the market, and HER2 or trastuzumab deruxtecan has made its way from later lines in therapy up until most recently, it's been the second line, so it was the treatment of choice once you progressed on the Herceptin and Perjeta. That's a very effective medicine. It works. It's an antibody drug conjugate, so it's one of those Trojan horses, smart chemo delivery systems. And it's given once every 3 weeks, which is more convenient than some of the drugs that we give once a week. And that has been very, very effective. And there's another antibody drug conjugate called Kadcyla or trastuzumab emtansine, which up until the last couple of years was the second line. That now that's one of the third line options. And then we have some of these, the small molecule inhibitors or the pill forms of, that forms of medicines that target HER2. Those are medicines like tucatinib and lapatinib. And tucatinib in particular has been very effective in treating cancers that have spread to the brain, which we know is a problem, particularly in HER2 positive breast cancer, because HER2 has this sort of honing mechanism through the blood-brain barrier and into the brain. And so it's a much more common problem in HER2 positive breast cancer than in other types of cancer. But tucatinib in combination with chemotherapy and Herceptin can actually shrink the tumors in the brain even without radiation. And so that was one of the first drugs that was found to do that. And we've since learned that Enhertu does that as well. But so those are sort of all of the combinations and different types of treatments that we can offer in HER2-positive breast cancer. And then the menu of options is long. So the list of potential treatment options is very long. Now we're really just trying to figure out how should we best sequence them. And we had some really, hot off the press data that was presented just this weekend. The American Society of Clinical Oncology met at our annual meeting in Chicago. It's one of the biggest meetings in the world for cancer specialists. And we had updated results from a clinical trial called DESTINY-Breast09. And this was comparing the Enhertu, the trastuzumab deruxtecan, and comparing it to that Cleopatra regimen that we've all been using now for the last 12 years or so. And what that clinical trial showed was that the Enhertu was far superior to the taxane, Herceptin, Perjeta, and that patients stayed on therapy longer and seemed to be living even longer. And so that's a really exciting potential treatment option. There are a few caveats that will be important for anybody who this is a treatment option for to discuss with your own specific provider, because what we often do now with the chemotherapy and the Herceptin and Perjeta is we give it for a few months and then we peel back the chemo. And we just have people on the Herceptin and the Perjeta, which are the antibodies, which have very few side effects. Some people have a few more than others, but for the most part, very minimally disruptive, other than the fact that you have to go in and get it every 3 weeks. And what DESTINY-Breast09 did was continue the chemo, the antibody drug conjugate, indefinitely. And so that presents a question as to whether do we have to keep all patients on the antibody drug conjugate for potentially 2-3 years, or is there a way for us maybe to do kind of an induction chemotherapy for a few months, and then the people who respond the most, we can peel back and then put them on a maintenance therapy with Herceptin and Perjeta. And that's really become, just in the last 6 months, actually, the we really reinforced that strategy. So in the Cleopatra study, they were allowed to do that. What we've done, you stop the chemo and keep going with the Herceptin and Perjeta. But the patients with hormone-positive breast cancer who are on that clinical trial were not allowed to get hormone blockers. And now in daily practice, if you're hormone-positive and HER2-positive, we absolutely recommend giving hormone blockers in combination with the Herceptin and Perjeta in terms of the maintenance. And so we've actually seen even longer responses and better responses in the real world than what was seen in Cleopatra, particularly in the hormone-positive subpopulation of HER2-positive breast cancer because of the benefit of the hormone therapy. And then in December last year, we had the PATINA study that Dr. Chumsri mentioned briefly that was presented that looked at after the induction chemo with the taxane and the Herceptin Perjeta, the hormone-positive patients started their hormone blockers. And then we also added a targeted medicine called palbociclib or Ibrance, which is basically a cell cycle blocker. It prevents the cell from going through the active phases of mitosis. And that showed really, really profound and prolonged benefits with with some additional added toxicity or side effects, but nothing that was particularly bothersome or difficult for us to manage. And so that, for the last 6 months, has been our new kind of standard of care in patients who weren't on the Ibrance, but were sort of in a short window of having received their induction and were on hormone therapy. We've been adding it in. And so now we don't know really where this fits, because if people are getting the antibody drug conjugate with the T-DXd or the Enhertu for years, we're not going to add the targeted therapy to it. So it's almost like it's definitely conversations that are meant to be had one-on-one with your own oncologist. It's not necessarily a bad problem to have. You know, we have all of these new medicines, and so it's really just trying to figure out where can we best fit them so that they're not competing against each other, and that we're optimizing not only how long we keep people alive, but how well we keep them alive and how we can minimize the side effects and get patients out living their lives and not spending as much time in infusion. So it's really, it's the best time to be undergoing treatment for HER2-positive breast cancer because of all of these new drugs. And we're still working out, and over the next years, we'll probably be working out more ways in which that we can optimally sequence these therapies. And then inevitably, there are more things that are coming down the pike, and that's really exciting too. So some additional data that we've had just this weekend and also within the last 6 months. In HER2, one of the very rare but more serious risks of it is something called interstitial lung disease, which is basically inflammation of the lungs, and it can be deadly. A small numbers of patients on all of these trials have died from their lung disease and not from their cancer, and that's obviously not at all what we want to do. We want to be keeping patients alive with the medicines and not causing really life-threatening side effects. And so we're very cautious about that, and we monitor patients who are on it very closely to monitor for any signs of inflammation in the lungs. And we saw some data this past weekend that patients who had low levels or low grades of this inflammation of their lungs, once, if they took a break off the Enhertu and they maybe got some medicines to tamp down the inflammation, and the evidence of that resolved, that they were able to safely resume the Enhertu, and most of them were able to stay on it. which is really great because it's such an effective medicine that you never want to be in a position where you have to stop something because of a side effect, especially when it's still controlling the cancer. We have other antibody-drug conjugates that are coming down the pike. We saw a small study of a drug called trastuzumab rezatecan that was especially effective in brain metastases. And then there are a couple of other novel tyrosine kinase inhibitors, which are those small molecule pills. And the advantage of those pills is that because they're small, they can get through that blood-brain barrier that has evolutionarily been designed to protect the human body from chemicals going into the brain. But when we want to give chemotherapy and we want to get it into the brain, that can be a problem. And so some of these small molecules are better designed to actually get through that blood-brain barrier and treat the cancer in the brain, even in the absence of targeted interventions like radiation. So several new medicines that are on the horizon, just to keep your eyes and ears out for. And the other topic that I was tasked with discussing is how research contributes to your treatment options. And if it's not obvious already, research is what creates your treatment options. And so if you have the opportunity to get on a clinical trial, every drug that we offer now as a standard of care FDA-approved therapy has been investigated in a clinical trial before it got to that point. And patients, just like those of you who are listening on the call, they volunteered to participate in the studies. And of course, you know, when you volunteer to participate in a clinical trial, you're not just doing it for selfless reasons to advance science. You want to get the benefit of the drug. And especially, excuse me, we saw this with drugs like Enhertu. I had some of my patients in my own clinic on some of the earliest studies before the drug was even approved, and it was life-altering for them. So clinical research trials are a way to get access to promising investigational therapies before they're available to the general population, but we have to do the studies in order to find out the safety and the best way to sequence them and to make sure that we're learning everything we need to before they're made available and approved by the regulatory agencies. And what's built into clinical research studies is that close monitoring, the safety focus, and making sure that somebody who's going on a clinical trial of a drug that's earlier in development, we don't want to keep you on that drug unless we know it's working. And so it's built in to have frequent scans and things like that, so that if it turns out that that's not the right treatment for you, that you aren't stuck on a study that's not working. So research is what defines the treatment options that are available for you today. And then the last topic that I wanted to talk about is what's new in the prevention and management of treatment side effects, symptoms, discomfort, neuropathy, pain. The bottom line for this is really just communication. Communication with your treatment team is key. We can't help you manage a side effect if we don't know about it. And with some side effects, the earlier we know about it, the more likely we are to intervene in a way to make a meaningful intervention. So for that, the classic side effect in that regard is neuropathy or the numbness and tingling in the fingers and toes that can happen with some of the chemotherapy medicines that we offer. We want to know about that as soon as it becomes more noticeable and persistent, because if it does become persistent, it can be permanent. We still haven't, we don't have a cure or a super effective way to prevent neuropathy. We've looked at a lot of different prescription medicines, a lot of different supplements and herbs and things like that, and nothing is clearly beneficial. Some small studies show small benefits, but there isn't any medical therapy that's currently recommended. But some of the newer interventions that we are seeing some good success with are cryotherapy and compression therapy. So cryotherapy is basically like freezing. So sort of wearing mitts and booties, ice mitts and booties that kind of constrict the blood vessels that feed the tips of the fingers and the tips of the toes, where those nerve endings tend to be most easily affected. And so that is something that we talk to our patients about in my clinic, both early stage and late stage breast cancer. It's not specific to HER2 positive. The main thing you have to be careful about with cryotherapy is frostbite. We don't want to cause frostbite. Compression therapy is basically just wearing tight compression socks or tight gloves, again, sort of to decrease the flow of blood. Exercise and regular exercise and acupuncture may also be beneficial for neuropathy and can help with a lot of other things. Acupuncture helps with many other side effects like joint pains, can help with nausea, can help with some of the menopausal side effects for those of you who may be on hormone blockers. And then cold capping is something that's becoming, I would say, much more widely available, at least in the United States. So that is a way that we can potentially prevent hair loss, which is a very traumatic side effect of a lot of the drugs that we offer. Unfortunately, it's not yet covered by insurance in most cases, but there are bills through various state legislatures that are hoping to change that. And depending on where you live, there may be some grant funding or other support to get that available. We're also learning about dose escalation strategies to help mitigate some of the side effects. This is particularly effective in things like diarrhea. So neratinib or Nerlynx is very classically associated with pretty severe diarrhea to the point where many of us oncologists didn't actually want to prescribe it, even in patients who might benefit, because it was so miserable. But we've really established a slow dose escalation strategy that essentially allows time for the body to get used to it and really minimizes the amount of diarrhea so that patients can stay on it. And then early identification and intervention of side effects, as I said, things like the neuropathy, also the interstitial lung disease that I mentioned with the INHER2, checking CAT scans more often so that we can intervene early so that we can reverse the process before it gets to a stage where you can't then go back on a drug that may be effective. So main bottom line for that is just talk to your care team. We have medicines for nausea. We have medicines for pain. We have medicines for anxiety, you know, a lot of things that the chemotherapy and treatments can cause, but we can't help you unless we know about it. And I guess I'll stop there and just leave some time for questions. But the bottom line is really that there have been a lot of exciting advances, and there's plenty more to come, so stay tuned.
Excellent. That was a superb presentation, Dr. Natro. Stellar. Lots of incredibly important information for our participants, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Ms. Cassie Spector, and Ms. Spector is an oncology social worker. She's a breast and gynecological cancers program coordinator at Cancer Care. And Ms. Spector will be addressing Cancer Care's key programs and services, Cancer Care Hopeline, 800-813-4673, our website. And she'll also be talking about the role of online support groups for people living with HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer. It's my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Spector.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. As mentioned, my name is Cassie, and I'm the Breast and Gynecological Cancers Program Coordinator and Oncology Social Worker at Cancer Care. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization providing free professional support services and information to help people manage the emotional, practical, and financial challenges of cancer. Our comprehensive services include resource navigation, counseling, support groups, educational workshops, publications, and limited financial assistance. There are many aspects of a metastatic breast cancer diagnosis that may be addressed through psychosocial supportive services. Making informed treatment decisions, quality of life concerns, clinical trials, and communication with one's medical team or loved ones are important topics that can be discussed with an oncology social worker. A cancer diagnosis can be very overwhelming. Additional support and guidance, as well as establishing a supportive network, may help relieve feelings of anxiety related to one's diagnosis. Individuals diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer may choose to supplement existing social networks by joining a support group or engaging in counseling. Many hospitals, treatment centers, and nonprofit organizations offer supportive services. Being a member in a support group can offer the opportunity to speak with others who are going through similar experiences, obtain information, and provide support. Cancer Care offers national online support groups for patients and caregivers including our metastatic breast cancer patient support group. Our online support groups take place using a password-protected message board format and are led by professional oncology social workers. Registration can be found on CancerCare's website, cancercare.org. On our website, there's also a wide array of reading material and information related to metastatic breast cancer. This includes recorded Connect education workshops, publications about speaking to your medical team, and coping with metastatic breast cancer. People diagnosed with cancer may also experience practical and financial concerns throughout one's treatment. CancerCare's resource navigation services offer a short-term, strength-based approach to patients and caregivers affected by cancer nationally. A trained specialist will work with the client in connecting them to resources, referrals, and financial assistance. If you're interested in learning more about the support services we offer, I encourage you to call CancerCare's National Hope Line at 800-813-4673 to speak with one of our oncology social workers. We are here to offer you support throughout this experience and look forward to hearing from you. It's been such a pleasure to be part of this very informative program. Thank you so much for your attention, and I'll turn it back to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Spector. That was a superb presentation. And we look forward to being on for the Q&A, because I know there'll be a lot of questions for you as well. So thank you so much. And now we're going to move on to the questions to our participants. And we're going to actually, I'm going to ask Sarah to explain to you how to queue up the question.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
Okay, and we have a whole bunch of questions here, so let me start with these questions. And this one is for Dr. Metro. Are biomarker and tumor markers the same? What does the tumor marker tell us? My tumor markers fluctuate.
Tumor markers, I think, are what you're referring to are the blood tests that we can check and that, you know, your local hospital lab or might do CA15-3, CA27-29, CEA or some of those, the most common. And those, they're not biomarkers really the way that we're talking about them. So tumor markers, some breast cancers kind of secrete like this protein that you can measure in the blood. And when the value or the number of the tumor marker is going up, that might be a sign that the cancer is starting to grow. If the number is going down, that's typically reassuring, but they're not specific. And numbers can go up or down for reasons other than cancer progression or regression. I've seen patients whose numbers go up and up and up and up every month for 3 years before they have actual growth of their tumor. So we never use those numbers to decide about changing a treatment. The treatments, the changes in treatment, as you know, today are still made based on progression that we see on scans, but they can be a tool to for the oncologist to decide how often to do scans, you know, if we should be starting to look for other things. I tell my patients all the time that if it was my choice, the patient would never see that number because there's nothing that it's going to do other than cause anxiety if it goes up by a couple points or a little or more than a couple points. But for me, it's just another tool in my toolbox that I use in a whole bunch of other, in combination with a whole bunch of other things to decide how well a medicine is working. And it's really what happens over the course of many, many months or years, as opposed to what happens from one test to the next. Whereas the biomarkers that we're talking about are things that can predict response to treatments, like the ER positive, some of the other types of blood tests where we do the DNA sequencing. Those are very specialized, and those help us determine exactly what treatments may be best, whereas the tumor markers are more generic.
Thank you so much. And a question for Dr. Shimsey. What would be reasonable to omit, when would it be reasonable to omit the Taxol in early triple positive breast cancer with no node involvement and no genetic markers, tumor size, less than 10 centimeters, clean margins after surgery, and only treat with Herceptin? If you could address this question in a general way, Dr. Shumsi.
I guess this question is referred for early stage breast cancer, since mentioned about node negative. So just to make it clear, for patients with early stage breast cancer, we normally use chemotherapy in combination with anti-HER2 therapy as an adjuvant treatment to help prevent cancer from coming back. Most often time, we normally combine it with chemotherapy because, unfortunately, things like trastuzumab or pertuzumab, when we use this antibody by itself, it does not work so well, but it works so much better when we combine it with chemotherapy. Currently, we have the clinical trial that looking at, but if you have like smaller cancer, there is a trial called APT trial that allow patients that have, smaller cancer than 3 centimeters. Most of the time, we usually use it in smaller tumor, like 1 centimeter or so, with no lymph node involvement. And that with, one single chemotherapy called paclitaxel with trastuzumab. And that's been shown to have a good, outcome. On the other hand, there's limited data on, early stage patient that not using hormone blocker. There was another trial currently ongoing called ADEPT trial that looking at, endocrine therapy in combination with trastuzumab and pertuzumab, but that particular trial result is still ongoing. There are some study that came out from Japan that looking at sort of like more retrospective study looking at using this endocrine therapy and pertuzumab. In that particular trial does not have pertuzumab, and it seems like at least in that retrospective outcome, when patients did not get chemotherapy, the outcome seems to be poor. But again, it's not a definitive study. We're gonna need to wait and see. Especially maybe if we add pertuzumab, it might be all right. But we do not normally recommend without chemotherapy because of that. Yeah.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And a question from Dr. Matro. Where does IV trovoli come in?
I'm sorry, IV what?
Trovoli, T-R-O-V-E-L-Y. T-R-O-V-E-L.
Trodelvy.
Trodelvy is sacituzumab govitecan. That's another antibody drug conjugate that's not currently approved for HER2 positive breast cancer. It's approved right now for triple negative breast cancer and for hormone positive HER2 negative breast cancer. There may be studies that are ongoing looking at combining it with Herceptin probably, but at this moment there's no indication for Trodelvy in HER2 positive breast cancer.
And for Dr. Shamsi, what is the benefit of doing a bilateral mastectomy, even though cancer is only positively biopsied in one breast?
The thing is that we know for quite some time now that patients with early stage breast cancer, if you are a candidate for lumpectomy, and again, you have to, each case are different, and you have to talk to your surgeon and healthcare provider to see whether the extent of the cancer is feasible for the surgeon to do lumpectomy or not. Because, you know, otherwise then you don't want to leave the gross cancer behind, right? Make sure that all of the cancers are removed. But on the other hand, if you are a candidate for lumpectomy, we know for a long time now that patients that have lumpectomy outcome is similar to patients who have mastectomy, but in patients that had lumpectomy, then they have to have radiation. So there's, you know, a lot of other if or and but condition, and each case are different. So then probably that's a question that you need to talk to your healthcare provider in more detail. But in general, if it is, you know, medically feasible, patients that have lumpectomy in combination with radiation has the similar outcome to patients that had mastectomy. So that's why we, you know, right now, lumpectomy is a preferred surgery if it's possible in that individual patients.
Thank you. For Dr. Mitro, do you order a periodic circulating tumor cell blood test such as Guardant 360 to track treatment response and or progression?
So Guardant testing is right now approved for as a ctDNA test for to determine mutations, not as like a response to treatment assay. I do use tests like that usually at the time of initial diagnosis and potentially periodically at times of progression, much more commonly in HER2 negative patients, but I still do sometimes use it in HER2 positive. There's a lot of interest now in things like Signatera, which is tracking kind of or circulating tumor DNA quantitative assays. Those are not standard of care because we don't really know what to do with the result yet. So, you know, if the number or value is going up, there are some studies saying that we could, that switching therapy early before they have radiographic progression, that may be better, but we don't, but the data is still early and we really don't know what to do with that. So generally I prefer to do it on a clinical trial. You know, if I have somebody who if we have a clinical trial that's looking at changing therapy based on a result of that test, then I'll send it as part of the study. But off study, I'm not routinely using that kind of assay yet, although it's possible that in a few years that may be changing.
Excellent, thank you. And for Dr. Shumsi, how common is leptomeningeal disease in cancer? Are there any new treatments which actually work?
Yeah, so leptomeningeal disease is just so that everyone understands what that is. So it's basically metastasis cancer inside of the lining around the brain. So that is unfortunately one of the difficult metastases for us to treat, as inside of our brain we have what we call blood-brain barrier that normally protect our brain from any toxins from the environment. So sometimes brain has become a sanctuary site for cancer cells. So, but on the other hand, the good news is that there's some other new drug that's coming out that can potentially penetrate the blood-brain barrier better. You know, the some of the what we call the tyrosine kinase inhibitor or small molecules inhibitor, that pill that Dr. Mader was mentioning to, those drugs tend to, you know, cross blood-brain barrier a little better than, you know, larger molecules. But on the other hand, there's some new data too, especially with, you know, leptomeningeal disease, because these blood-brain barrier are not quite intact. So some of the bigger molecules, thing like that, you know, antibody drug conjugate, the Trojan horse like Enhertu or trastuzumab deruxtecan, there are some newer study showing that it's also can cross blood-brain barrier too. So there are you know, some clinical trial efforts on looking at that particular treatment specifically for leptomeningeal disease. There's some early data care that it may, like things like, you know, NHER2 or T-DXd may work. Some other tyrosine kinase inhibitor, like that small molecules inhibitor pill, may also can cross, but then there are things like tucatinib, and then there are some other new drugs that are coming out called like ZN-1041 that has some CNS activity, also is quite promising. Yeah.
Excellent, thank you. And quite a few questions here. We'll take a few more, but let's see. So, question for Dr. Matro. Since there is not a mammo print test or oncotype for HER2 new patients, will HER2 people need chemo and Herceptin Perjeta regardless of the amount of invasive cancer?
So that's probably more, again, of an early stage question, but there's some newer data emerging for a test called HER2-DX, which is very similar in terms of what information it provides for as a prognostic and predictive test, so determining who's most at risk and who potentially benefits more from chemotherapy. So that's something that's still in the works and still being validated, but it may be that we are able to de-escalate some of the chemo in some patients who turn out to be lower risk on that assay, but we don't have prospective, meaning looking ahead data. We just have stuff looking back, and we really want to see how basing treatment decisions on that result might impact long-term outcomes. So it's still a little bit early, but there are similar tests in the works for HER2-positive breast cancer.
Excellent. And for Ms. Spector, a couple of questions about support groups. What advice can you give for those interested in joining a support group, and what does the availability look like for an online message board support group versus a video support group? How are the message boards moderated?
Yeah, of course. So in terms of a message board group, so specifically to the message board group that Cancer Care offers, we offer a number of different types of groups. So I mentioned the metastatic breast cancer patient group. We also do offer caregiver groups as well as those who are bereaved. So we offer those groups 3 times a year for 15 weeks at a time. And those groups are moderated by oncology social workers. So you can log on at any time, read other people's posts, and then post yourself. And they're accessible 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So you can log on at any point. And there's no, like, live component to it, so there's no live feature. So that's the difference between an online message board format versus a live support group that may be on Zoom or maybe in person. Cancer Care does offer live support groups, which are on Zoom for New York and New Jersey residents, if you're interested. So you could check out those on our website. Or if you're located somewhere else across the country or in another country, you can absolutely see what local organizations are available in your area that may offer support groups, or even sometimes cancer centers do offer support groups, so you can always check in with your treatment team, see if a support group's offered there, or if they can connect you to any community resources. And you can also call our Hope Line, the number that I provided earlier, and we're happy to help you find any support groups that's available to you in your local communities or just nationally in general.
Excellent. And I'd like all the speakers to offer takeaways at this point. So we're going to conclude the call with our speakers' takeaways. I'm going to start with Dr. Shrim. So just a minute takeaway, what you'd like people to take away from today's program. Dr. Shrim, see if you would go first. Let's just give people a minute.
Yes. Thank you, Dr. Mehta. I think my main takeaway is that, you know, there are a lot of new exciting treatment coming out. I think that you already heard from all of us today. So, you know, hopefully the outcome of HER2 positive breast cancer will continue to improve. I think we have so many new treatment coming out. So it is truly an exciting time. And thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much. Dr. Mehta.
Yeah, I would echo that. I think there's a lot of new things that are happening really as we speak. The landscape is changing, and just encourage you all to talk to your care providers, you know, seek out clinical trials if where they may be available, and just really communicate well with your team. But there's a lot of new exciting developments, and we hope that we will continue to make progress with this disease.
Excellent. And Ms. Spector?
Thank you. I would say for my takeaway, I would really to know that you're not alone. Know that there is practical support resources, support services. Reach out to your treatment team. Reach out to local community resources. And really know that you're not alone, that there is support available for you to reach out to.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And I want to thank all of our speakers. You've been phenomenal. I want to thank all of our participants for your really excellent excellent questions, actually. And although we couldn't take all your questions, we took quite a few of them. I think I want to echo what the Spector said, that you're not alone, that you're now part of the community of support. We're here to help you. And to some extent, you can simply call the Cancer Care 800 number, 813-4673, or visit our website at www.cancercare.org. And also, most importantly, we also want you to be aware of your healthcare team, and that many people have found that evenings, weekends, and holidays are a difficult time to reach their healthcare team. So please be sure to call your healthcare team to find out who is available weekends, holidays, and evenings, because that seems to be the most difficult time for people to reach their healthcare team. So really check with your healthcare team as to their availability. But you can always reach your healthcare team during the day, but not so much on the evening. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today. I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone have a great day.